Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When the president delivers a State of the Union address, I always like watching the cutaways of lawmakers either clapping or scowling, depending on political affiliation. The party with the most seats changes from election to election, of course, but there is one overwhelming majority that has existed since the very first United States Congress. The ratio of men to women is more than 5-1 even today. Women have gained widespread acceptance in other professions that were once the exclusive province of men, for example, making up nearly half the enrollment in U.S. law and medical schools. So why don't more women run for elected office? And how does their underrepresentation affect democracy? This Saturday, the Ignite Texas Young Women's Political Leadership Conference, Ignite Change, takes place at Texas Wesleyan University. The organization exists to build young women's political ambitions, and we are joined now by two people who will be there to offer support and inspiration. Ann Moses is founder and president of Ignite. Judge Tanya Parker is judge of the 116th Civil District Court. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thank you. Welcome. Glad to be here.
How is it that a country as modern as the United States lags behind so many other democracies in terms of gender parity?
Well, internationally, we've actually written the Constitution for a couple of countries where we've required that 30% of their federal legislatures include women. So in Iraq and Afghanistan, we wrote those constitutions. In America, there are a whole There are a number of factors that keep women out of the process, but they are not electoral. They really are more social. Women feel less qualified to run for office. They also overvalue the qualifications necessary to run for office. They aren't asked or recruited as much. Family roles get in the way, and then women tend to find the mechanisms of running for office more distasteful than men tend to find those same mechanisms.
So this has been an issue since the country began. Can you talk about how you decided to found the organization in 2009?
Yeah. So I had been working for a number of adult women's political organizations that were either recruiting women to run for office at that first time or supporting those women when they were making bids for congressional seats or state seats. And it was really in the context of working for those organizations that I realized we weren't getting anywhere. Every year we were hearkening back to 1992, which was sort of the famed year of the woman, when, suddenly the numbers of women in federal office increased dramatically. And I think we got up to about 9% that year. And we have since inched up very, very, very slowly to now just over 18% federally. Over 20-something years. And, you know, I was 21 in 1992, and I remember the year of the woman. It was really the first year I became kind of politically aware. And every year that we have an election, we the media gets all excited. Is this going to be another year of the women? And either we drop back a little bit or we pick up a couple percentage points. And it just became clear to me that until we stopped just focusing on women who could run today and started focusing on building the next generation of leaders and really trying to get masses and masses of young women to see this as a possibility and even a calling, we were just never going to get there.
Judge Parker, talk a little bit about how you found your calling. Was running for elected office something you dreamed about as a little girl?
Not as a young child, but certainly early on in my legal career, I started to have thoughts about making a contribution in that way. But as has been stated here, issues of self-efficacy or the lack of a sense of self-efficacy and not being surrounded by a lot of women in the political arena really caused me to have a lot of trepidation about my ability to make the transition from being a lawyer to becoming a public servant. But nevertheless, I prepared myself. And I think that, you know, whether you're talking to Jennifer Lawless and looking at studies that she's done with the Brookings Institute, or you're reading Sandberg's book, Lean In, these are really the issues, as has been touched on, that are keeping us from being able to make the transition and put our names in the hat to run for office. Because And I don't mean to suggest that it's as simple as we are the thing holding ourselves back, mm-hmm. but because certainly a lot of things contribute to our sense of ourselves, the things that drive us to feel like we've got to be overqualified in order to be qualified. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of factors in our communities, in our households, in our workplaces that contribute to those feelings. But at the end of the day, we've got the responsibility for making the transition from feeling that we can't do it to saying that we can and doing it. And that's why I've been such a supporter of the Ignite organization and other organizations that are interested in encouraging girls to see themselves that way, because that's exactly where it starts. Is you've got to be able to change your perception of yourself from being a follower to being a leader. And you have to have the sense that you have a voice that's meaningful and that people will want to hear and follow. And all of that requires a lot of work by a lot of folks in our lives, family, community, workplace.
I was interested to read the research that said that parents talk to their sons more from the earliest ages about the possibility of something like a political career. I don't think a lot of parents today would think of themselves as only encouraging their sons to do this sort of thing. How does that happen?
So the research you're referring to is the same research that Tonya referred to by Jennifer Lawless, who's out of American University. And she's done a number of studies on adult women and adult men and why women aren't putting themselves forward for candidacy, and now younger women. And she hasn't really looked at the why. Why are parents doing that? But certainly the fact remains that young women are not socialized to think about political leadership or civic leadership in the same way that young men are, not just at home but also in school. And then another factor is that young women are less comfortable with competition, which may come from the difference between boys and girls in playing team sports.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's been a while since Title IX was passed, and it does seem like young women are embracing the idea of themselves as athletes in greater numbers. But is there something about, you know, are girls more likely to really do like a team sport as opposed to an individual sport? Or is there actual value to learning to compete on something like the soccer field for, you know, 30 years later when we might run for office?
I think absolutely there's value to it. I get the opportunity to go back to the school district where I grew up, Richardson Independent School District, and where I was educated. I go back on a regular basis, and I spend a lot of time talking to the faculty and the staff. I've been invited to speak in those settings, and one of the things I stress every time I go back is the fact of how sports in that environment put me in a position where I got a set of skills and tools that I rely on every single day to meet the challenges of my job. So I do think that sports make a huge difference. And of course, there's extensive data to support all the ways that sports improve young girls' chances at success later in life. And the contribution that it makes, though, is it teaches you, importantly, which you've got to have if you're going to be in politics, that failure on an issue is not the end of the road. Mm-hmm. And you have to have that sort of resilience and ability to bounce back quickly from a failure, a fall, a tumble, or whatever. You've just got to be able to get back on your feet very quickly and keep moving. That's a lesson that's just embedded in most sports programs that you would, you know, be involved with. And it's invaluable to being able to successfully navigate both a campaign and once you get into office, because it doesn't stop. You know, you're still facing those issues. It gives you the chance to be able to navigate in that environment.
And comfort with competition. I mean, running for office is hard. It's hard work. Someone's going to lose. If there's more than two candidates, more people are going to lose. And you have to be okay with the idea of failing. And what the research shows, and also what I've seen just from working with these young women and teaching college and talking to college women in particular, is that they're not comfortable with they don't want to do it if they don't think there's a pretty good chance that they're going to win. And, you know, many people run for office once, twice, three times before they win. And so sports, I think, prepares you for that.
Would you say, Judge, that even if the election had not gone your way, that there would have been a value to your career in just the experience of running?
Absolutely. And I have a number of colleagues who went down the path that they were not successful, or they were successful but were only able to serve one term. And they talk all the time about the contribution that it made to boosting their profile and helping them from a business standpoint to attract attention to themselves and their practices in a way that they would not have had. But also, you know, when you learn to sell yourself, which for women is the most difficult thing to do, but once you learn that, it's very easy to go sell your product, to sell your service, to, you know, that's easy once you have successfully figured out how you sell yourself. And so when you are able to go through this experience, whether successful or not, you take that away. That ability to stand in front of groups of people and say, this is what I have to bring to the marketplace. It's good for you because. And it just is helpful in, you know, any variety of things that a person would want to go on to do after that.
There is no other profession that requires people to talk about themselves in quite the same way that politics does, right? And an effective politician has to say, I will do this for you. I am the most qualified. I have this experience. Women in particular, girls in particular, are socialized to let someone else praise them.
Oh, that's right. I'm also adjunct faculty at a college in California, and I teach a women in politics class, and I always find it so amusing. It's a women in politics class, and we don't hide the fact that we want them to run for office. And the first day when I have them all say who they are and what office they're interested in running for, and 28 out of 30 will say, well, I'm interested in being chief of staff or the person behind the scenes. And it's really because of this discomfort with saying, actually, these are my ideas, they're good ones, and everyone get behind me. I'm the leader. You be my chief of staff. Women have a very, very hard time. It's almost like ambition is a dirty word, or even wanting to say, I want to be in front and my opinions are valid and I would make a wonderful leader. They feel afraid to say that until they have every single qualification in the book and that it's, you know, irrefutable from the mass public. And I just don't think men are hampered by the same feelings.
Do you think any of that is an unintended consequence of the fact that women have been told for a long time you have to be twice as good in order to compete? Like, it's the sort of thing, given, you know, the fact that historically not as many things have been open to women. A lot of people raise their daughters saying you've got to be better than any man you're competing against. And so they internalize that in maybe not the way that they were meant to.
I think that's absolutely something that contributes to the phenomena that we have, where we just feel like we've got to be extra qualified, overqualified to be able to do the basics of a job that we're presented with. But I also think that part of the reason that we have that sense is because the world around us suggests that even when we are more than, we still don't get a lot of opportunities. And there are a lot of reasons for that, not the least of which are reasons that are internal to us very much, as we've talked about here. But there's this idea when you come to the table, particularly the political table, you feel like there are going to be a lot of people who are against you being successful. Mm-hmm. You just sort of take that on. But when you take that chip off your shoulder, you really begin to see, actually, I can get through this door if I would just put that down, because there are more people who are interested in seeing me be successful. There's this great report that the Pew Center put out that did an evaluation of all of these traits that are traits that people would traditionally want to see in their public servants. And there are things from honesty to hardworking to decisive and all these different categories. And it's about 7 or 8 different categories. And what that study revealed is that in all of the categories except one, when people gave the ratings, they said women were equal to or better than men in the categories. The one category where that was not true was decisiveness.
Yep.
Wow.
You've seen that. And so I think it's very interesting that one category is the place where people still have the concern that we're not going to be able to make the decision and move on because of these things that we've talked about. So it's really important that we start training girls in that way.
We're speaking this hour with Judge Tanya Parker of the 116th Civil District Court and Ann Moses, founder and president of Ignite. The Ignite Texas Young Women's Political Leadership Conference takes place this Saturday, February 21st at Texas Wesleyan University. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs, accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The Ignite Texas Young Women's Political Leadership Conference, Ignite Change, takes place this Saturday, February 21st, at Texas Wesleyan University. We are speaking this hour with two people who will be there, Ignite founder and president Ann Moses and Judge Tanya Parker of the 116th Civil District Court. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Ann, how does Ignite work exactly? You go into high schools and also into universities.
Yeah, so we have two different tracks. We run largely an after-school program at different high schools across the region and in other states as well. We hire and train and supervise college and grad school women to deliver our program, which is about 40 hours long over the course of a year. It's a combination of issues education, not what to think, but how to think about the most pressing policy issues that are going on in their own communities. We do some civic education because that's really inadequate in high schools at this point across the country. And then we bring in loads of elected women like Judge Parker to talk to our young women, because if you can't see it, you can't be it. So that's our high school program, and it operates year-round in high schools. On colleges, we have a college chapter model where young women who are really politically ambitious can find other young women like themselves on campuses, and they form Ignite chapters. And what we have for them is a bunch of programmatic material and curricula they can deliver themselves, or they can also access our network of elected women leaders who are happy to come and speak with them and mentor them. And they can organize civic engagement type activities on their campuses. And it's really a place for those young women who can say at that point in their lives, yeah, you know, I think I might like to be an elected leader, and I want to be surrounded by other women who are ambitious in the same way that I am, and start and continue to build that leadership.
Judge Parker, I'm interested in the kinds of things these young women ask you. Are there like the very loftiest questions and also the sort of nitty-gritty questions about how you actually go down this path?
Absolutely. Let me just say the young women that they train are dynamic. When you walk into the room and get an opportunity to present, and it really is an opportunity to get a chance to present and dialogue with them about what it is to be a public servant, they are prepared. They have got your materials. They've reviewed every step of your journey. And so they were grilling me on everything from, you know, just how I would talk about issues with my family, how we made the decision as a family to do this and how it would affect them and me. We talked about, you know, my education and how I prepared myself in that way. We went even to the level of having a discussion about how I dealt with financial aid in law school and in undergrad, and importantly, how what strategy I employed to retire my student loan debt so that I could be in a position to be able to seek public office and leave private. It does. It absolutely does. And I was very candid with them about the approach that I took to retire my student loan debt so that I could be in a position to leave private practice and transition into public service. And so they come with a wide variety of questions and very prepared to talk to you about every step of the journey.
And I think that's why, you know, we want the young women to ask these honest questions. They haven't met an elected leader, right? And so, and they oftentimes think that women like them or girls like them can't get elected. Hmm. And that's not true, actually, because what they really see is, you know, there are 500,000 offices in the United States, but the only ones that we focus on really as a nation and in the media are president, members of Congress, right, the House and Senate, maybe your governor. Young people aren't even necessarily aware that the entry point for politics is not senator. It's probably school board or, you know, city council. And those offices are important. They actually make vital decisions. And guess what? You can get elected to those offices. No, you're probably not going to be a viable U.S. Senate candidate right now. But if you start in your community, which is a community you know and a place where you actually can identify what the issues are and probably can identify what you think would be some great solutions, and then meet women like Judge Parker who actually come from these same communities, right, and have run for office and won, suddenly the light bulb goes off. And then to not get a campaign speech from her, but to hear her real story about, well, you know, I had all this student loan debt and I had to get rid of it before I ran. And, you know, I have a family and I need to talk to them about what are the implications about me running for them. That's the real stuff that holds people back. And I think it's great for them to hear the real story and then see that it's doable.
Last year, I spoke at the Ignite conference and actually did a PowerPoint presentation and a workshop with the young ladies about the pros and cons of being an elected official. And we really drilled down in that workshop about the fact that you are going to, you know, for me in the position of judge, my First Amendment rights are abridged to a certain extent, that you don't have any secrets. Your life is public, and that, of course, it touches on your family's life and makes there are security issues, and we sort of drill down on that. But I hope that at the end of the day, I left them with the impression that it's worth it. And then we really talked a lot about what it is that makes the work so gratifying, because I never want to present a rosy picture to people about what we do as public servants. It is very, very difficult work, and it takes an enormous toll on you and the members of your family. But at the same time, you know, I don't meet people in this arena who say I'd have it another way. Most of the folks, my colleagues who serve, they wouldn't trade it for the world, you know. So that's the message I want to leave them with. I want to be very real with you about these challenges are abound. But at the same time, the work is so fulfilling. Being able to make this type of contribution to your community with whatever your background is, it makes it worthwhile.
Why does it matter that there are approximately the same number of women in elected leadership as men, or the same number of women that would, you know, reflect the national population? From a practical standpoint, from the standpoint of those of us who are affected by the actions of these leaders, why should we care?
Gender parity is a great thing on its face, but it's really more than just about having everything be equal and fair, as my teenager likes to put it. It's democracy is about having representation of all the voices of our country, right? And I think that different groups of people, and, you know, women are a different group of people, think differently and conduct business differently. And we're seeing, I mean, there's all kinds of evidence of how women govern differently. Back from, you know, a couple years ago when the government shut down, it was two women with vast ideological differences who actually brokered the deal to end the government shutdown. And they could agree on nothing, except for the fact that the shutdown was bad for the American people. And with that, they figured out a way to compromise. I think that's just one example of the way that women govern differently. But I think it's really important for our democracy to actually reflect our populace, right? We want that in private sector, and we want that in the service sector as well.
I want to talk about a little bit more about this family issue and the issue of timing. And I want to tread carefully here because I always resent the implication that, like, family issues are only the problem of women, because I know a lot of professional men who care very much about their families. And I don't think it's fair to assume that moms take care of everything or wives take care of everything. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are some things that women want to be doing for their families that they don't really want to give to someone else in another position. And I think about someone like Nancy Pelosi, who, love her or hate her, is a force of nature. She didn't run for office for the first time until she was 47 years old, and she has said she wanted to wait until her kids were older.
Mm-hmm.
How much is that a factor for young women who might start their political careers earlier, and what do we do about it?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's funny. Generationally, it's the research is showing that the shift is happening where young women don't think it's going to be as much of an impediment as women my age feel it actually is an impediment. But the message I always want to give is that you don't have to wait to run for office. I think it intersects with this sort of feeling, the need to be uber qualified.
Get all your ducks in a row.
To get all your ducks in a row. Because if by the time you naturally feel like, oh, you're ready, well, you probably are, frankly, encumbered in a career and raising children and probably or possibly have elders that you're caring for at mm-hmm. the other end. And then, of course, running for office, which is, again, your first run is probably going to be a local office, part-time, paid poorly, and a third job, frankly, at that
What's
point.
What's not to love?
What's not to love? So, you know, what one of the things I want to do is encourage younger women. You know, we're not talking about, again, the U.S. Senate. When you want to run for that first office, get qualified, get involved in your community, be a viable and true community activist and someone who's really working for good and for change in your community in whatever way that you think is the way that you want to do it. And then run. Don't wait until you're 40-something and you're encumbered three different ways, you know? And then once you get you're in, you know, you're an elected official and you're actually serving, you'll figure out the rest later, you know?
The other component of that is we have to send the message to young girls that the fact that you want to have a family is not a reason to not think about a future in public service and in political office. And what it is it is a reason for you to be more thoughtful about who you partner with to have a family and how you have that family, because you want to make sure that you've got someone that you're partnered with who's going to make the contributions that you need them to make in order for you both to be successful in whatever your career aspirations are. And then the other component of it is that as you're thinking about, you know, who you partner with, well, they probably are going to be as ambitious as you are. You've also got to get comfortable with the fact that sometimes you are going to have to get some help and it is going to have to be hired. And you are going to have to get comfortable with that. That doesn't mean you're going to have a live-in nanny if that's not what you choose for yourself. But will you have someone perhaps help you a couple days a week to pick up groceries or pick up kids or do whatever so that you and your partner can reach whatever your professional ambitions are? Sure, you will. And you need to just get comfortable with that and stop guilting. Don't get into the business of guilting yourself on having to have those resources to help so that your household runs more smoothly. And we just have to start putting that in just getting it into the mindset that it's okay. Because even before going onto the bench in my law practice, you know, I just saw women so torn about this idea that they were picking their careers over their kids because they were at work at 3 o'clock instead of picking a kid up at school. And a lot of that was just self-inflicted. And they just, once they got to the place where they realized, you know what, it's okay if 2 days a week I get help or 3 days a week I get help so that I can rise to my ambitions, things were just much better. And I think it's just something that we have to teach.
And culturally, it's not that men don't care as much, but they're not. So my husband has never felt terrible that he's not picking up the kids at 3 o'clock. And I have felt terrible. And he's a wonderful guy and he does 50% of the stuff. But it's something that we do to ourselves. Sure. And then it becomes another impediment, right?
I bet he's also not been bothered when you've asked him to do it.
No, not at all. Happy to.
Something we have trouble doing.
Right.
And we're just doing it to ourselves. It's not that we don't have a good partner who's willing to step forward and provide the support. We're not willing to ask. Mm-hmm. And we got to get over that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Olivia in Fort Worth. Hi, Olivia.
Hi. I'm so excited that this topic is being shared. I am a Hispanic American, and I know that there's not a whole lot of males or females who are Hispanic, and especially not females in office. And so I'm really excited that this is a topic of conversation. My question is, among the young ladies that you are seeing, have you noticed any racial disparities between, motivation between the white young women and Hispanic young women and African Americans and Asians, and how they're feeling about running for political office, like their motivation level?
Interesting question. Thanks, Olivia.
That is an interesting question. I have actually noticed none. Mm-hmm. And part of it is probably that we're getting, to a certain degree, when we go into schools and colleges, we're getting young people who have already self-identified as having a potential interest in not necessarily running for office, but at least in the notion of service, right? And, you know, the typical young woman that Ignite attracts is a young woman who is concerned about some issue in her community. It can be one of a gazillion issues. And then she wants to do something about it, but she doesn't know how. What's the entry point to fix this? And she has ideas about how to fix it, right? And so with that within – if those are the young women we're serving, I've noticed absolutely no racial differences, none whatsoever.
In the times that I've spoken through the Ignite program, the schools that I attended, the demographic was very heavily Hispanic. And so I think that that translated into the program where the number of Hispanic young girls that were involved in the Ignite programs at the schools that I spoke at, Irma Rangel and at the Peak Preparatory, for example, there were scores of Hispanic females very interested. And I think that's super important because that is a group that we, particularly in Dallas County, we've struggled to get them involved at the levels that they can be involved in terms of voting. And I think that it's because we haven't offered them all that we can in terms of leadership. We have some wonderful, dynamic Hispanic politicians and elected officials, but we can do more. And I think that when we do more, we get that base more excited and more willing to come out to the polls. So we're working on that for sure. And so I'm real excited when I go out and I see all these young Hispanic women who are really interested in a future in public service.
Judge, you're now in a position where you are mentoring other people. I wonder, though, if actively in office, if there is still someone that you like to communicate with that you feel like maintains a role as your mentor.
I do have people that I go to that are advisors, men and women, probably more men than women, and I think that's just a function of my profession is dominated.
Numbers.
but that's changing. You may know that in the Dallas County Democratic primary in 2014, the women carried the day. I mean, every single woman who challenged, who was on the ballot, who whether they challenged an incumbent or if it was an open bench and they just had a male opponent, they won, every single woman. And there were a lot of male incumbents who had a lot of money in their treasure chest, and the money didn't matter. These women had a message. They were highly motivated. They campaigned very hard, not to suggest that the men did not, but they edged them out, and they were able to get, again, the base excited about them and get them out to vote in the primary. So I do have wonderful mentors, male and female, and you know that's something that is essential to be able to continue to do the work and do it well, that you have advisors.
We're speaking this hour with Judge Tanya Parker of the 116th Civil District Court and Ann Moses, founder and president of Ignite. The Ignite Texas Young Women's Political Leadership Conference takes place on Saturday at Texas Wesleyan University. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about inspiring young women to get involved in politics as candidates for elected office. The Ignite Texas Young Women's Political Leadership Conference happens this Saturday, February 21st at Texas Wesleyan University. We have Ignite founder and president Ann Moses with us, as well as Judge Tanya Parker of the 116th Civil District Court. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Tim on the line in Dallas. Hey, Tim.
Hey, great show as always.
Thank you.
I need clarification. I think I heard correctly that at the beginning of the show, we have actually helped to put together constitutions for governments in other countries. And I assume this is under the idea of promoting democracy, where there is a requirement for a certain percentage of women to be a part of that government. And as a father of two daughters here in America, I find the hypocrisy of that, the irony of that, is just, it makes my head want to pop open. Can you guys talk a little bit more about how that process has happened, what the process was, and help me?
So I'm referring to Iraq and Afghanistan, where we obviously engaged in democracy building there, and we helped put together their constitutions that set a minimum threshold, and I can't remember if it's 25 or 30% of their legislatures or their parliamentary system to be women, to be comprised of women. Now, how it works, I believe, is I'm not sure exactly how it works on the ground. I think it has to do with slates and because they have a different system. It's not a two-party system. But yes, there's a minimum threshold.
In this country, have we gotten beyond the point where women candidates can count on women to vote for them and not necessarily, you know, get the vote of men? Have we stopped voting along gender lines?
We have, yeah. I mean, all the the original research and the early looking at whether or not voters were receptive to women candidates was really kind of theoretical because there weren't that many women candidates. So it was really, if there was a lot of, surveying, if there was a woman candidate, would you be more or less likely to vote for her? Well, now we have evidence that, in fact, when women run, voters vote for them or vote against them at the same rates at which they vote for or against men. Gender really doesn't make a difference anymore. So it's kind of a mathematical equation. The reason why we don't have more women in office is because we don't have more women candidates. And now, of course, more recently, with this country has gotten more and more partisan. Party trumps gender in terms of who people are willing to vote for.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Katrina's on the line in Keller. Hello, Katrina.
Thank you for taking my telephone call.
Sure.
And I love you have such a great voice, by the way. And I'm a speech language pathologist assistant, so I love listening to your program.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I just wanted to say also the judge's comments about, I hate to use the word so, in a trite manner, but work-life balance, and it really speaks to me because, I have 2 university degrees, 2 children, and a home, and I've always been interested in politics. I'm trying to do my HOA, start grassroots here. And my question is, based on their experience, what is the difference between someone that in management style, particularly, what's the difference between someone that has gone to law school versus someone that has not gone to law school? Because, I'm just paying off my student loans, and I think as a mom and a healthcare professional, there is a lot of, merit. Not all women have the ability to go to law school. So what management approaches do they think they find is really effective for women? Because sometimes we get kind of typecasted for being too direct, or not always, but I just wanted to ask. Thank you for your time.
Thanks. We'll get some thoughts for you, Katrina.
First, let me say that the last data that I looked at on this issue in terms of the professions that we get our elected officials from said that women traditionally have come from healthcare and education.
That's right.
Whereas men traditionally have come from business and law. So the fact that she's in the healthcare profession, off to a good start there. And I think it's outstanding that she's getting involved with her homeowners association and perhaps running for something there. Because as was talked about earlier, it definitely starts with those very local level positions and just sort of moving your way up from there because you get greater confidence. I'm a big proponent of you've just got to get a win. Once you get a win, you get your legs under you and realize you can, and you go get the next one. In terms of how you manage it, I mean, there's no question that when lawyers come into the courtroom, I've got to manage a lot of different things in terms of their perception of who I am and how the courtroom environment is going to be run because and on many levels, who I am, whether it's African American or female or whatever the circumstance that perhaps they've got in their heads. And sometimes that involves me really taking charge of a situation so that I can let them know I'm driving and I know how to drive. And at the end of the day, you're going to be happy I was driving because I know what I'm doing here. Now, the way that you go about doing that, I think that for me, the number one thing is that I always start from the position that this person does not intend anything offensive by the way that they're interacting with me. It's just that they're not used to a woman being an authority over them, and they may be struggling with that right now, and so they're fighting with me for authority. In the 116th, that's not a battle that's going to be won, and it's not one
by
that
them, anyway.
Not by them, and it's not one that I'm going to engage in. It's really we're not going to battle for power. What's going to happen is I'm going to call a timeout, and I'm going to take that person to the side, and I'm going to give voice to what's happening. So a good example is I had a gentleman we were in trial, and every time the other side, it just happened that the other attorney was female, and every time she would object to something that he, a question that he had posed that was improper, he would say, I'll rephrase. And he would do that before I could rule on the objection. Now, that happens occasionally, and you don't want to be oversensitive about it, and you usually just let the proceeding go on. But at some point, it was happening so much that I felt I needed to call the timeout and take him to the side and say, Counselor, when your opponent lodges an objection, she's directing that to the court. Mm-hmm. It's for me to rule on, not for you to wave off and just move the proceeding on. And you're doing that because you don't want the jury to see that you're being out of order and her objection is going to be sustained. And so why don't you just stop asking bad questions? If that's what you, if what you want to do is keep it, the power in your hands, you stop asking bad questions, you won't draw the objection, and I won't need to rule. But as long as an objection is made to your question, I'm going to rule on it. You don't get to wave it off and just keep moving. And but I did it outside the presence of the jury so that it was something that let him know, I don't think that you're doing this intentionally, but it's got to stop so that I preserve the integrity of the process, and there aren't power issues going on between us. So you employ all kinds of management techniques, but I think the best approach is to start from the position that people don't intend to be offensive. This is some, in some ways new to them, having women on the bench and practicing in front of women. Some of them have been practicing for 3 decades. And to walk in the room and see a female on the bench is something that, you know, they've got to get used to. And because in their lives they don't often find themselves under the authority of a woman, it takes a minute.
I also want to pick up on something that the caller said about, you know, you have 2 university degrees and wondering if you need law school. Now, Judge Parker's a judge, so yeah, she had to be a lawyer first. But I feel like this is something that women do all the time where they think to be on the school board or the mosquito abatement board or name your board, they have to have a law degree and, you know, a BA, a JD, a PhD, an MBA. You know, you don't need to have all those degrees. It's part of that overqualification feeling that I have to have every single base covered. What you need to do is be truly bona fide involved in your community and working on behalf of the betterment of your community, be that as part of your HOA or because you're on the board of a wonderful nonprofit or because you work in healthcare or because you're a teacher. That's your credibility. And you don't need to amass a pile of degrees and a pile of debt to run for local office or even for other offices, really. So I don't want the caller to think that she has to sort of, you know, keep going and mass more and more and more. That's what holds women back.
What kinds of networking and socialization experiences do you recommend to young women who might have self-identified or might have had, you know, a teacher or somebody say, you really ought to consider this? What kinds of things should they be doing besides just educating themselves and maybe starting off in their careers?
One of the things that we promote is we always say, you know, work on a campaign, find a candidate, preferably someone who's sitting in the seat that someday you might like to occupy, and someone who you admire who's sitting in that mm-hmm. seat, right? And go and work on their campaign, because there's no better way to demystify the process of running for office than volunteering on a campaign, particularly at the local level. You know, everyone assumes it's going to be TV ads and radio shows and, you know, spots on air. And really, it's a lot of door knocking. It's mm-hmm. a lot of phone calling. It's retail politics. And it's really going out into your community and asking, telling people what it is that you want to do and asking for their vote. So find a candidate you love, preferably in the seat that you want to hold. Volunteer on that campaign. Really distinguish yourself. Tell the person who's running that if they win, you want to work for them, right? So get involved that way. Get involved in a community issue that you care about. Doesn't matter which one. An issue that you personally care about. Establish yourself as a leader around that issue, be it as a volunteer, a board member, a staff member, whatever it is. Candidates don't come from nowhere. They are people that other people in the community can point to and say, you know, she does what she says. I know that if she promises me she's going to do X, X will get done, right? So it's establishing yourself as a true part of your community and a leader in your community.
I would add to that by suggesting that people get involved in political groups that are in their community. I mean,
yeah.
When I began to run and realize all the different clubs that I was going to have to stop off at on a regular basis in order to visit with them and engage those folks who are very involved in the political process in their respective precincts and communities, that's when, you know, you would just be amazed at the number of elected officials that you're going to just meet being in the room at that club, because those elected officials are there to communicate and interact with their constituents, and in some instances to seek the endorsement of that club in their next race. And so it's a great place for you to get relationships with elected officials where you then could work in those campaigns and things like that. And then if you're not, you know, some people want to seek nonpartisan positions like on the city council or the mayor's office or whatever, and you're not a real political person, then community organizations and seeking out your elected representative and asking for an appointment on a board.
Yes.
That's how I got started into politics. There was a DART station near the neighborhood that I lived in, and I noticed that there was no trash can, and people regularly would throw trash on the ground, and I felt like it was an eyesore. I contacted my city councilwoman, and she said, "Oh, I'm interested to hear that you're so interested in this. Hey, what, are you interested in community things and keeping your community nice and neat?" And I said, "You know, of course, obviously I'm reaching out to you on this." And not only did she get a trash receptacle put at the DART station, she appointed me to serve on a commission.
Who was that?
It was Linda Coop. Mm-hmm. And she appointed me to serve on a commission, and I got a wonderful opportunity to do that. And that really was my first sort of civic board that I got a chance to sit on as a commissioner, and it was wonderful experience. But it started by me reaching out to my elected official about a need that I had in my community, and that relationship went both ways. And when I launched my campaign, she was there. And so I highly recommend to people community organizations and political clubs.
Certainly having America's first black president doesn't mean the end of racism. It is indication of progress. I wonder about America's first woman president and the signal that will send to young women in particular.
I think it'll send a terrific signal.
You know, it has the potential to do that, much like what's happened with the – I have the concern that there will be fallout in the other direction, if you will, as we've seen with the president. I mean, there are a lot of people who say race relations today are not better, they're worse since the president has been in office, and I'm not attributing that to him.
Because people say, well, we have a black president, so there's no problem.
There's that, and then there are a lot of people who feel very strongly that a lot of the opposition to him is solely on the basis that he mm-hmm. is African, a person of African descent. And so that is an issue that I fear is something that we'll have to deal with in connection with our first female president. But, of course, that's not a reason to not make it happen.
Yeah.
But it is something that we will have to deal with, where there are going to be those segments, large or small, of people who just are going to oppose her because they don't want certain things to happen on the watch of the first female president. And that's unfortunate. But, you know, like I said, it's not a reason to not have it happen, but it is something that I suspect will happen.
Judge Tanya Parker joins us from the 116th Civil District Court. Ann Moses is founder and president of Ignite. The Ignite Texas Young Women's Political Leadership Conference happens this Saturday, February 21st, at Texas Wesleyan University. It's been so wonderful to have both of you here. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.